Good morning and welcome to the Miller Center Forum. Ron Suskind is perhaps America's leading journalist and author writing about the current presidential administration. But he didn't start his career writing about modern presidents. After graduating from the University of Virginia and the Columbia University School of Journalism, he worked for several different publications. From 1993 to 2000, he was the senior national affairs writer for the Wall Street Journal. There, Suskind won the Pulitzer Prize for feature writing in 1995. His award-winning articles were enlarged into a book, A Hope in the Unseen, An American Odyssey from the Inner City to the Ivy League, which follows a young man from inner city Washington to Brown University. Incidentally, Ron, that book has been assigned as summer reading for the upper school students in one of our local independent schools. So you should see a spike in the Amazon. So.
I'll check my Amazon number.
In his recent work, Ron Suskind has demonstrated again that there is no substitute for well-informed inside sources. No writer today has achieved greater success in getting inside players to talk for publication. His 2004 book, The Price of Loyalty, George W. Bush, the White House, and the Education of Paul O'Neill, is a sweeping tour of the inner workings of the Bush presidency, as we all know, among the most secretive administrations in modern times. His article in the October 17th, New York, 2004 New York Times Magazine, without a doubt, quoted Bruce Bartlett, a domestic policy advisor to President Reagan and a Treasury official under Bush 41, as saying that the current President Bush is animated by an instinct, quote, that is this sort of weird messianic idea of what he thinks God has told him to do. It takes a lot of talent to get an insider to say something like that. His latest book, The 1% Doctrine, Deep Inside America's Pursuit of Its Enemies Since 9/11, was hailed by the New York Times as riveting in developing its argument that under the leadership of Vice President Cheney, quote, suspicion, not evidence, is the new threshold for action against our enemies. The book has been featured on the Today Show and other network news programs, was the subject of a major article in Time magazine this week, is the basis for a Frontline PBS special, and has been the number one bestseller on the Amazon list ever since it was published. Mr. Suskind will sign copies of the 1% Doctrine in our library, which is at the far end of the building, but still on this floor immediately following today's forum. Please join me in welcoming Ron Suskind.
Are we on? Can you hear that? Thanks, George. It's getting to be a regular thing for me, coming down to Charlottesville of late, and I love coming to Charlottesville. You know, you think about what you learned in college, and if any of it's going to be of any use going forward, other than things you might have learned late at night at the fraternity. And actually, there's more than I thought that's of utility. I think, coming to this age and stage, you know, you... often against your will, suffer some received wisdom. And, I think about that Jefferson line, you know, one of his best, for here we are not afraid to follow truth wherever it may lead, nor tolerate any error so long as reason is free to combat it. I think if Jefferson were here today, I might hire him as my attorney. To make that argument in the highest courts in the land, I'm frankly not exactly sure how he would fare. These are interesting times, as the Chinese tell us in their curse, and they are right. I think the challenges to the things that make our democracy distinctive, the uniqueness of this form of self-governance, are under subtle and ardent, even pernicious challenge. It's born right from instincts within all of us that have been harnessed like a force by people throughout history. Fear is a profound and powerful motivator. A state of emergency, ongoing, without a ready conclusion in sight, creates opportunities and a lack of boundaries and latitude for power, which needs no advertising department. It does its own marketing as to the preservation and expansion of self, of itself. That's the way power is. It's like one of those self-sustaining machines, like that, what was that computer in 2001, A Space Odyssey, where you couldn't unplug the damn thing. this is a time that I thought a lot about when I was writing the book. What's going to happen once the thing is published? Frankly, I'm heartened more than I supposed back when. People who have read the book up to now are understanding what guides this process, this project, the ideas, not just the episodes and incidents. Now, obviously, those are they're the octane in the engine. They drive the news cycles. But people are saying, yes, yes, but it's not just about hydrogen cyanide attacks in New York. It's about this broader issue of how we conduct ourselves at this time in a way that does not affront the character of this nation, yet is effective. These are the twin horns, the horns of dilemma. Let me tell you a little bit how this project began and how it unfolded without revealing any of my sources. And so you can get a sense of the arc of the themology, if you will, the thinking. I find when I write books that I start with questions and I seek some answers. I don't tend to offer hard answers in the text. I don't. I certainly have strong feelings. But the fact is, I think in this era of sort of spored and democratized information that's downloadable and available on the planet everywhere, that people are sort of empowered to seek answers on their own. What I try to do more, I think, is frame the debates with the kind of questions that are appropriate and offer the nutrition, the nourishment of the key information that heretofore you might not have been graced with. This is tricky to do right now. So, why would I do such a thing? Well, the Paul O'Neill journey, The Price of Loyalty, was published in the January of 2004. And of course, that was a very noisy run. By the spring, I was starting to think about what I might do next. O'Neill, of course, had given me 19,000 documents, if you recall. Which meant I hired an assistant immediately that morning. And the documents formed a nice foundation for some questions that would emerge that were not, for the most part, attacked in The Price of Loyalty itself. The way that book was written, O'Neill is the protagonist. Like all great stories, you need a protagonist. A person goes on a journey, they find on the rutted terrain, challenges. What they learn alters them, and then they return home, and you say, what's different? That's the way journeys always are. Joseph Campbell's right about that. We keep telling the same story again and again. O'Neill, essentially, then, is the protagonist of that book. If O'Neill was not directly in kind of collision, conflict, discussion, debate on key issues, they tended not to end up in The Price of Loyalty. It's just the way it was, the way it was built. And O'Neill didn't do a whole lot on the War on Terror. But there were things in those documents that were helpful. And you know what I realized? I realized I knew almost nothing about the War on Terror. Almost nothing. Here I'm living in Washington. I've got a press pass. I've got terrific access, by and large. I know nothing, not a zip. I'm like, what is that all about? Why is that? And I started to examine what I knew and how I knew it, and I realized that almost all of it was born of a kind of thin gruel of official speak. I know this is sounding Dickensian, isn't it? Me in a bowl. You know, may I have some more, please? Please, I'm so hungry. And the head of the work farm, the school, is saying, no, no more. That's all for you. All of you. Just one bowl per person. I started to think about why that was and what was different about that. What was different about the way the tectonic plate, the plates of American life beneath the surface, the way they shifted, the way the sort of orbs, the balance of power inside of a government, inside of the sort of organ of government, which includes we in the Fourth Estate, had been altered. I thought about the conflict. Think about it. A war. Let's call it a war. Different kind of war, but one that's going to stretch a while. Maybe a low-grade war. Maybe a secret war. Think about the idea of a war with a big W that's conducted in secret. Think about that. Well, I don't know if we've had one of those. Usually in wars, we have, you know, the Ed Murrows and the Ernie Piles traveling with the troops, reporting back, dispatches daily. You know, for better or for worse, you can kind of see it. What happened in the Remagen Woods? What happened in the Bulge? What's the upshot in North Africa? Not here. And I said, you know, is there a way that somebody could essentially be a kind of Ernie Pyle here to travel with the troops? Now, obviously, I'm not talking about the troops doing their level best heroically in Iraq. Because another posit that underlies the project is that Iraq, as regime change and nation building, well, that's part of an older model. You know, we've done a lot of that. Countries, powers have done an awful lot of that. That's really old school. Pardon my lingo there. What changed? What changed is this. Is that lovely democratizing light of information, which is offered really of late, for the most part, to dark corners of the globe. I mean, there are computers everywhere. Every dusty village has a television set now. That's a huge change. If information and knowledge certainly is power, people are empowered in ways they had not been 20 years ago, much less 200 years ago. That means they're able, no matter what their station, whether they are a have or a have not, to seize hold of the really Western, for the most part, ideal. And I trace that back to one of those great conversations, whether they happen or not, of God and Abraham. I love this one. You know, basically, Abraham's a confused guy just like the rest of us, but even more so, because in those days, you know, you pretty much believed back when, X thousand years ago, that you were born and you lived and you died in the same spot. You know? It's just the way it was. You know, there was a sense of stasis. And God says to Abraham at some point, a big day for God. He was very good this morning. And he says to Abraham, Lech Lecha. Abraham looks at him quizzically. Huh? What's that mean? Now, looking at this audience, I'm thinking some of you don't know what that means. it actually means go forth in Hebrew. Lech Lecha. Now, this is wildly heretical thinking by God at this point. And Abraham looks at him vexed and says, go where? Go where? God's go up ahead. Just go. From this instant, this one moment, two important things emerged. It's like they are created by like a point of precipitation, of light shining through darkness. One, the notion of uncertain future. Two, and this is the big one, that of individual destiny. And then it is written by those terrific early Hollywood scriptwriters, Jews of 5,000 years ago, written elegantly. Individual destiny. You are in control of your own ship. Make no mistake, that puts burdens on you, no doubt. Success or failure, it's on your ledger. Up ahead. Of course, we are all the heirs of that moment, of Lech Lecha. Certainly we in the West, in the Judeo-Christian tradition, I think pretty much all over the world. Now, around the world, people are empowered on that point of individual destiny by the fact that they can tap the Library of Congress online all over the planet. But this phenomenon has brought its dark cousin to the party, destructive capability. That's the dilemma. And it is a profound one. Violent intent, the destructive power once reserved and held tight by nations, can now be placed in the hands of small groups, transnational actors so-called, in an increasingly borderless world, or even individuals. Bracing. It is. It is the central challenge of our time. Make no mistake. And in fact, it is a challenge to the state-to-state dance of force and diplomacy with all of its roots, you know, and our friends, our Metternichs and Talleyrands and George Kennans, who thought very clearly about how to do all that effectively. We have prospered in this country by doing that dance of force and diplomacy particularly well, state to state. That is eroding. It's a challenge. States say we still matter. The transnats say, oh, not for long. 9/11 was a big moment in that drama. A transnational movement, individuals ardently poised, did something to America that no state, no angry state, no opposition state has ever managed, though I'm sure some dreamed of it. It's a huge change. People will be clear about that, I think, after the next attack, and there will be another one. And altogether, people will say, now tell me again what we're doing in Iraq. One more time. Yes, no one wants another haven for terrorists. There's about 19 of them now. Iraq would make 20. That's a bad thing, but an incremental step. So I said, what about this war on terror? What is it really? This is the change. How do we fight it? How do we win it? What is the arc of the struggle? And then I sat in my office and waited for the phone to ring. It's a quiet time. And I started to meet with people at the Bread and Chocolate on Connecticut Avenue, if any of you have been to Washington. It's right up near Chevy Chase Circle. It's one of my favorite spots. And there are people inside of the government whose names I knew, who are increasingly willing and ready to say a few things that need be said. That's been an ongoing step-by-step process. The start in 2002, when I started reporting on the Bush administration, those stories in Esquire before the price of loyalty, there was hesitation. The codes of message discipline, of control, message control, were hard and fast and immutable, unmovable. But people eventually, over time, said, now tell me again, what is it exactly we have to fear about the truth? Tell me that one more time. Especially public servants, in some cases people who spent decades trying to embrace a notion of the commonweal. After a while, they say, you know, I'm really being treated more like a child who is seen but not heard. Even though I'm an expert, They don't seem to want to, in any way, entertain the thing that we've worked so hard on. I don't think they read it. Why am I here? And, 7:30 lattes, that's fine when the sun's coming up. It's an interesting dance. Many of them were afraid. They were people on the very front lines of what we call counterterrorism. Essentially, they are the combatants in this war. And they're at places like the FBI and the CIA and the NSC, and they're throughout the government. And they're coming mostly because they're afraid. Make no mistake. They're not coming because they like me. That's clear. I can only buy them so much coffee. That's clear. They're coming because they were afraid. Afraid about people not knowing what they ought to know. That's why. Time and again, they'd say the same thing. I'd say, now this thing we're talking about, is this, I know everything down to the lunch menu now is stamp classified. I know that. And that's been part of a concerted, right from the start plan by the vice president, who believes that nothing as to the deliberative process, nothing of the whys, why the government does what it does, need be told to the public. Judge us on our actions. The president and the vice president both say that clearly. You deserve nothing more than that. That's the way it works. Well, it hasn't actually up to now. But the fact is that I would say to them, well, I know that this is non-public. Is it a problem? Is it a problem, or would it be a problem if it were published? Namely, specifically, would it in any way advantage our enemy? And if it would, God knows, we're not going to talk about it here. And in every case, they said, God knows, Ron, I fight the battle every day of my life. If any of this information advantaged the enemy, you would be the last person I'd tell. Almost all of this, they would say, in an instance here or there, has been known by our enemy 2-3 years ago in some cases. They've already responded to it strategically. It's part of past tense. And then they'd say the thing that drove so many of them. But you know, what I fear, they'd say, is that after the next attack occurs, people would say, how could you not have told us what you knew? We can handle the truth. It's the way it works here in this country. We're the bosses. We, with the big W, we're the sovereign. And after the next attack, they would say, how could you not have told us? And if we don't have a response, frankly, they'll be out in the street with torches. They'll be so angry. And that's what drove them. And another thing, tactical. What works? Time and again, intelligence will never be so precise. Two, on balance, know the place and time of an attack. It just won't. It's too serendipitous. It's too fleeting. What works is a public that knows what it sees when it sees it and knows what to do. Why hasn't there been a mall bombing in Israel in, I don't know, 10 years? Because people in Israel, going about their life, you know, just like us, happy as they pass their quotidian day-to-day, they know what things look like. So they see something odd, they whistle to the security guard, and the guy often never gets into the mall. They catch them in the parking lot. And so people told me things. And from those things, insights emerged. The real, genuine playbook of the U.S. and what's really occurring in this war. The book, of course, is filled with those things. Some of them, frankly, are bracing and create fear. You know, I'll just be very frank about that. You know, say, good God. I was hoping for answer B, not A. B is easier. B helps me sleep better. And A challenges me to know what I need to know. And I'm so busy right now. Who has the time? Of course, that's not the American response that's done us well over the years. What do I learn? The first big thing is the core of the United States playbook for this era. War on terror, Iraq, Afghanistan, what is it? Let me set a scene for you. It's November after 9/11, 2 months. The CIA has gathered some bracing intelligence and is making its presentation. The scene is one out of a kind of shared nightmare. It's August prior to 9/11. Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri, his deputy partner number two, are meeting around a campfire in Kandahar 3 weeks before 9/11 with two Pakistani nuclear scientists, Mahmoud and Bashir. These two guys, especially Mahmoud, he's sort of the head of their Atomic Energy Commission in Pakistan, was for some years. He's not AQ Khan, the sort of, you know, wild, destructive, entrepreneurial criminal who built their program and then sold it to countries around the world. No. Mahmoud is another guy, but he knows what he knows, and it is the pertinent material, and he is sitting with bin Laden. They brief the vice president. Folks from the CIA and the NSC are there in the Situation Room, and Cheney is screwed down tight. Some people might say that is a virtue in these times. And he is thinking deeply. Fear will do that. He says, you know, we need to think about these low probability, high impact events in a different way. Yeah, he is right there. And the briefing unfolds, moving toward completion, and he stops the proceedings. He says, all right. If there is a 1% chance that these scientists have helped Al-Qaeda in the development of any sort of nuclear device, essentially that WMDs may have been given to terrorists, if there's a 1% chance, we must treat it as a certainty. Then he demurs, exhales. Not in our analysis, or the preponderance of evidence, I suppose, but in our response. Everyone in the room sort of stops. They all know that this is a profound invention in terms of the lights of the policies that have guided us up to now. Think about it. It separates the traditional twins of analysis and action. Cheney, after all of his years managing the policy process, often very artfully, creating what I often call bureaucratic events, shaping it, making it turn out the way he might have liked it to turn out at the start, Cheney is exhausted from that. And he says, you know, it's not going to be about evidence or the policy process or the search and find of the known and the knowable and the competing voices and get me the best available facts and let's boil them down and get a new set. No, no. This is going to be about action. And if there is a 1% chance, we must act as if it is a certainty. It is a, just to keep that all in your head at once is a lot. And what does that mean? That means the United States officially at this point and through the meetings that would follow, all the way through to now, has embraced this Cheney doctrine, this 1% doctrine. One point I wanted to call it, folks were encouraging me to call the book The 1% Solution. You know, playing off that old Sherlock Holmes thing. Well, you know, I pulled back from that because, you know, I don't know if it is a solution or not. I didn't want to make that point in a title. I think the debate that's unfolding now is it really a strategy? Is it a kind of tactical default and not much more than that? Does it create coherence as to policy, as to the direction of the ship of state? But it does guide affairs in the real war on terror, much of it conducted in secret. What does it mean? It means that the threshold for action of the world's lone superpower might well and often would be simple suspicion. Frankly, there's probably a 1% chance that Jerry Belisle has a weapon of mass destruction right here in the front row. No, Jerry, probably not. But definitely not. But no problem. Get you off that watch list, Jerry, anytime now. But the fortunes for Muslim American men or for people who stumble into the wrong place at the wrong time around the globe, people who might be there picking up a wire transfer that they don't know the design or origin of, someone who's on the wrong phone line, someone who's in the wrong phone tree. I think almost all of us have probably ended up in the wrong phone tree at this point, the way the NSA does it. Each of us would probably fall under that enormous umbrella, that wide rubric of a 1% chance. Do we have a choice? We're not. This is the experiment. The experiment unfolds across the next 4 years, right to this instant. At this point, we are filled with panic about a second wave attack. We weren't very clear about the enemy and what their playbook might be, about what drove them. You know, there's a posit, it's very ancient, know thy enemy. We had failed on that score. And know thy enemy not only holds the seeds of victory, but also of mercy. It's hard to speak that word in this realm. Mercy. You know, Danny Pearl, one of my best buddies, I was sort of a mentor. There were others, but one of them at the University at the Wall Street Journal. You know, it's a harrowing time. It's hard to embrace some of the things that provide a kind of salvation, both tactically, intellectually, maybe even spiritually. Victory and mercy. Know thy enemy. You know thy enemy. You know what they might do next. Demonize them. Call them evil. They are subhuman. They are not like us in any way. the construction of their human character bears no resemblance to anyone in this room. I think Hannah Arendt would have a counterpoint on that one. Look at the atrocities that the Nazis commit. And then think of that Eichmann in the docket, of the banality of evil in many cases. Are we able to embrace an idea, which is one that enlivens me and has, that people do what they do for good enough reasons? They may not be your reasons or my reasons, but they're good enough that intent flows to action, the thing you can see. I don't think we have almost any idea what those sets of good enough reasons are for our enemy. And until we do, we will be blind. We won't know where they're going and why. And so we struggle. Things occur. Alerts galore. We are running around like a gigantic chicken and no head. Everyone is suspicious. There are alerts on I-95. If you see something suspicious, please call. Well, a guy just ran the damn toll booth. Is that suspicious? What is my threshold? Is there a 1% chance that, honey, did you get the license plate? I don't know. It's no better at the top of the government. They're in various states of agitation and sometimes almost panic. Alerts come through. What do? The president is deeply engaged. The book shows that. Some people in the White House like it because of that. They show the president and the vice president engaged almost every day. Boom, boom, boom. It also shows how the two men conduct their business, their offices, and relate to one another. I've been doing that for a couple of years. I think we've made new ground, headway in this book. The relationship between Cheney and Bush and how they guide this ship of state. They're up on the deck with the wheel. Intelligence comes in. It's mostly from the CIA. Be clear. The CIA is the central organ here, the point of the spear. NSA flows in, other members of the so-called IC, the intelligence community, flow in, but it all collects at the CIA and it routes up. CIA, White House. That's mostly the war on terror. Now you have FBI over here, and mostly they're saying, can you give us a job description? Look, they're smart guys, they're public servants, some of them are quite heroic, but they're not an intelligence bureau. And intelligence, the ability to, quote, light up the battlefield in this so-called war, is the key. You don't know where to aim the weapon, or the muscled up unit with the night goggles. You don't know where to send them. The White House learned some things, new features, new unique qualities of what it's like to be a government in this era. Some of them are unpleasant lessons. Some of them are strangely enlivening. We make our first big capture, Abu Zubaydah. We haven't had a big catch. It's already March of 2002. We didn't get the prey in Afghanistan. The book shows that the president and the vice president were warned in due time by the CIA. Move the troops over. You've got Marines. Get them to Tora Bora. But that advice was not the advice that was embraced. So bin Laden is clearly gone. Zawahiri may be dead, but we don't have him. We got nobody. Then we get Zubaydah. Zubaydah has popped up on signal intelligence. All these words are going to be part of the lexicon soon enough, if they're not already. SIGINT. That's what it's called. It's in italics in most newspapers. SIGINT. Comes from the NSA. It's emails, phone calls. On the vast global web, they're listening. They collect. They're gigantic computers that push through their algorithmic efforts to figure out what all of those nouns and verbs mean. SIGINT has picked up the name Zubaydah for years. His real name, not an alias. His real Zubaydah. Well, the name he uses. We think he might be a big deal. And then we get him. And then we find out otherwise. You are not told the otherwise. At that point, it is trumpeted far and wide, Zubaydah. You know, the president, Condi, everyone's out there. You know, we got him. The pointing. He's an operational chief. Look, I can understand his desire to tell us this thing that we want to hear. And clearly, Zubaydah is captured. We're interrogating him. We find out, well, there's a reason that his name was popping up on SIGINT all those years, is that he's a recruiter. He's sort of like the guy who runs the travel office at your company. He's doing lots of logistics, you know, making sure the kids have enough money and the wives and that, you know, people getting the right flights, that kind of thing, all right? Nonetheless, we don't hear too much of that. We hear he is the incarnation of evil, that he is the key player, one of them, no doubt. Maybe a number three, we're thinking. Meanwhile, inside of the analytical shops at FBI and CIA, they're reading Zubaydah's diary. And it's interesting, it's quite extensive. Clearly, it's the gem in the hall from the house in Pakistan where they captured him. Zubaydah right now is in interrogation. He was shot three times when we caught him. We sent the best doctors in America, some of the finest medical attention you could, over to fix him up, as someone in the CIA said, to bring him back to good health so we could begin to torture him. Sounds like healthcare in America, doesn't it? And they do torture us, don't they, those HMOs? Meanwhile, they're looking at the diary and going, what is this? 10 years of tiny, trifling nonsense of who said what, who drank which cup of tea in the voices of three different people, Hani 1, Hani 2, and Hani 3. Hani 1's 10 years Zubaydah's junior, Hani 2 is his age, and Hani 3 is 10 years older. He's got a split person. He's schizophrenic. Around the bend. Expendable, probably. We don't hear about that. Welcome to the war on terror. You are on a need-to-know basis, and those needs are generally defined by those in power. And you know the way they generally define such needs. Stuff is locked up in the classified vault. There's no way you'll ever know otherwise. The fact is that some people will offer sanction to this Bush administration for this sort of thing. But, you know, the fact is, I think it's a broader issue. Almost any government in power at any time would use this latitude, this creative license, to its own good gain, unless they are stopped from doing it. How could they not? Interesting thing occurs, a lovely little moment in the war on terror. Not long after we get Zubaydah, and he does give us some information that's valuable. He tells us the name Mukhtar. Now, that's a code name. Mukhtar means brain in Arabic, right? He says Mukhtar is actually Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. He is the operational planner of 9/11. He is a real operational chief. That's a big break for us. That's good. We get that from Zubaydah. We don't, frankly, get it from all the nasty interrogation stuff, the waterboarding and the death threats. We get it, frankly, from the stuff that the FBI recommended, the old school stuff of debriefing, so-called. Build a relationship. Surprise him. If you meet his expectations and all the Al-Qaeda guys think we're going to, you know, disembowel them, basically, kill them. If you meet their expectations, then everyone slips into their role, the interrogators say, certainly at FBI, and you don't get anything. Surprise them. We've done that through the 1990s. The FBI interrogated many Al-Qaeda lieutenants, Al-Qaeda lieutenants. I still use the bad pronunciation. Al-Qaeda is right. And, you know, and they surprised them saying, okay, you need more to eat. Huh. They're shocked. In one case, your wife is sick. She needs that operation. We can do that for her. Huh. You don't say. They did that for her in this one case, and the wife was fixed up, and after she got out of the hospital, she went to her husband and said, okay, now, honey, you tell them everything they want to know. That's actually the way the world tends to work. One of the lessons here. Don't divorce yourself from all that you know. Some of it may come in handy in this battle. It's a lovely moment right here in our own neighborhood. A guy named Dan Coleman, who's sort of the Al-Qaeda hunter for FBI. He's a brilliant guy. You know, he did a lot of those interrogations, the prosecutions in the 90s that were so successful for the World Trade Center bombing in 93 and the Khobar Towers and all that stuff. Dan gets a call. He's got to go out to Dulles Airport in the middle of the night. Top secret. Dan rolls out of bed. He's a guy from New Jersey. He's from a long line of, you know, Irish toughs. You know, some cops in the family. Dan's one of these clear-eyed, no-nonsense, cut-to-the-chase Irish. I'm married to a lovely Irish Catholic woman. I have a whole family of these people. I love them. I love them all. And so Dan gets up and gets in the FBI-issue sedan and drives out to Dulles. It's up the road. It's the middle of the night. It's quiet. Dulles is lit up like an ark for its own enjoyment at 2 in the morning. Dan pulls up to the General Aviation Terminal. A couple of guys waiting for him, just got off a plane. One of them is a guy named Steve, a guy in Army Intelligence. Special Forces. He's actually trained as a social worker. I don't know what that means, but I guess that makes for a good intelligence guy. And another guy, a colonel, and they're standing there and they've got this this box. And Dan says, that it? And Steve says, yeah, suppose so. Hands it to Dan. Cracks it open, reaches in. It's Zawahiri's head. Welcome to the war on terror. How did Zawahiri's head end up at Dulles Airport? Well, you can stretch all the way back to 600 AD, about birth of Muhammad. The growth of Islam, the conflicts within, if you want to drill that deep. You can talk about men who are educated in the Muslim world, finding other ways to show their ardor and enterprise. Angry at the quote-unquote apostate regimes, often supported by America, oil revenues and needs for oil. In any event, the head arrives here. Because there's a reward for Zawahiri, $25 million. We think he's dead already 4 times. At this point, though, some Afghan warlords get together and say, we got him. And we say, well, you know, it's a show me, pay you deal here. We need evidence. Evidence. Remember that word. It's changing. It's a little-y now. Getting littler all the time. So they go and they go digging. And they go to a riverbed and they dig up the head. He was buried and the snow then thawed. And the head ends up, so it's got some river mud as Dan reaches in, lifts it up. And they look at it there at the General Aviation Terminal. Three of them. Heroes of the struggle, fighting the fight, these men, this global game of cat and mouse, of swords crossing. They all look at it. Huh. Now, it's in the middle of the skull, which is mostly skull and a little skin, they see a there's a prayer scar in the middle of the forehead. Huh. Zawahiri's got one of those. And they sort of say, huh, it kinda looks like him. Now, of course, they're dying that it be him. We all are. Dan puts it back in the box, sticks it in his car. That FBI sedan, just a brief digression, is the sedan he drove in Southern Manhattan on 9/11. Dan was called into service immediately and zipped down to Washington to answer questions from people on high. Never got a chance to really deep clean the car. So there's a fine residue, just a little film of ash. And so now the head is placed among the ash of our sorrow. A rolling American-made burial urn, and Dan speeds back to Washington to bring the head of our enemy to our leader. Doesn't turn out to be the head. It's a guy named Maury from Hoboken. retract that. But there's great expectation. And that expectation rises like a wave through the power corridors around Washington. And even affects policy. Well, if it is the head, and if it is Zawahiri, the brains, you know, Bin Laden's Cheney, so to speak. Okay, that's a little jaunty. Maybe I shouldn't have said that, but then what will that mean for the war on terror? Maybe that means it's time for the next stage. Maybe it's time for Iraq. Well, Mr. President, we want to check the head first. It's going to take a little while. We need to get a DNA sample. Oh, no, I understand. It's natural. You want things to be as you hope they can be. In this case, interestingly, we do find enough tissue in the molar to do a DNA match. Now, what you need is a family member, and so this is one of these key moments of the war on terror. I'll open it up for questions after a minute here. I know you all have some. And so we say, great, we've got a sample, and Zawahiri's brother, Mohammed Zawahiri, is in Egypt, in custody, has been for some time. So someone from the CIA picks up the phone and calls over to his counterpart in Egypt, and says, we have a DNA sample looking for a match, and we understand, you know, you have Mohammed Zawahiri, his brother. And the Egyptian says, it's not the problem, we'll cut his arm off and send it to you. The CIA guy is literally, don't hang up! vial of blood is all we need, it's a vial of blood. The Egyptian seems deflated by this modest request. You want blood, we send the blood, whatever you want. Yeah. It's a story that has many shadow qualities and layers. You know, that phrase, I'm gonna go medieval on you, that tough guys use in movies, like Pulp Fiction. Well, the fact is, if we are drawn into a medieval posture, show our anger and our ability to match destruction with destruction, we will lose. I'll just say this. At the end of the book, I use something else that I learned here at this fine university. I was a student of a fellow named Ken Thompson, who was once the director of this place. Here in this place, right before I graduated, Thompson put me through hell. I was a student that had a lot on my mind. I was an activist. I was having a lot of fun. I had one of those lawn rooms, and that was a blast. And at the end of the day, Thompson said, "You know, Susskind, we're you know, you ought to at least once while you're here at the university give 100% doing something in a classroom." I said, "Okay. Now, how do you do that kind of thing?" And he says, "What we're going to do is you're going to become a student of the Masters of International Thought, and primarily George Kennan, and then we're going to do an oral here. I'll bring some of my best graduate assistants, and we'll sit you down like they do at Oxford, and we're going to grill you. You tell us when you're ready. That's your decision." I'm like, "Oh, God, can't you give me a date?" "No, no. When you're ready, you tell us." And right over there, we talked about George Kennan. You know, college, when it works, teaches you a big thing. In high school, you could get by being clever. In college, if it works, you've got to learn to be authentic, at least in some realm of real scholarship. That's what Ken does for me. And that's in homage to him, and that I place Kennan at the end of this book. If there's a 1% chance, if the threshold is mere suspicion, you are dancing perilously close to the fault line where ends and means connect. Kennan says a lovely and profound thing. He writes it in his diary as he gazes as a young man across Dresden, which in World War II, 40,000 civilians were killed. And Kennan is wrecked by this. And he says, if the West is to preserve a moral departure point as it goes forward, befitting its high ideals, it must attain sufficient superiority that it does not have to create Dresdens. A moral departure point. Right now around the globe, everybody everywhere knows of our dilemma as to ends and means, as to suspicion being the threshold for action for the world's most powerful nation. The old posit that you learn in law school, and I'm probably phrasing it with the numbers a little off, but we all know it. It's sufficient that 10 guilty men go free, that one innocent man is not convicted. Now the equations are officially reversed. The 1% doctrine, and what guides us now, is that it is fine and tenable that 100 innocent men, 99 innocent men, may suffer, that one guilty man is caught. Those 99 multiply into 999, 9,000, 9 million. And with each action born of insufficient evidence, there is a counter-reaction. There's a reason. There's a reason Gladstone does what he does and says what he says. There's a reason the foundations of democracy are based on the known. There's a reason you get to face your accuser. And in some court where the people decide, evidence drives the proceedings. It's not just because of you know, some Pollyannish horse and buggy concept. It's at the heart of the democracy. To make sure you don't make a mistake. It's to keep us from the Abu Ghraib, to keep us from the excesses of Guantanamo, to keep us from rounding up. My God, you should look at the documentation on the Arab-American men rounded up after 9/11. A man sitting there at a 7-Eleven with an airline credit card, one of the Delta Airlines American Express cards. Well, he's clearly from somewhere over there. Bing. We need to have a real discussion, and we need to do it now. A big, messy one about where and how the lines should be drawn as we engage in this seminal, defining struggle. Or we will make profound errors. We have made many already. The book has in it both sides. There are victories where you'll say, thank God. And there are moments when you'll say, oh, good God, no. Those are lessons that in some cases have been learned and in others have not been learned by those engaged in the fight. And frankly, they are lessons for us to learn and debate. Our leaders are the leaders that we deserve. They work for us. They are shaped by informed consent, with an emphasis on the first part of that phrase, informed. We are all in this together. And when America all gets in together, all of us, as one with shared purpose, we do extraordinary things. I'll just end with one final note. Corollary to our friend George Kennan. These days, in an era when much of the planet is suffused with religious certainty, I go to a very old text. There's a phrase in the Bible, the Hebrew Bible, tzedek, tzedek, tirduf. Any translations on that one here? It's a beauty. You should keep it on your wall. Tzedek is justice. Justice, justice. This you must pursue. Justice is mentioned twice. The old Hebrew scholars agree on why. They don't agree on almost anything, as you can imagine. Justice is mentioned twice. Once for the ends, once for the means. So I wish you all strength. Fight well, and God bless. Questions? Oh, God, political office, Mike.
Second of all, you mentioned two words a number of times. You said our enemy.
Yep.
Would you define that a little more clearly?
It's a great question. I love you asking that. Who is our enemy? You know, there's something called the hearts and minds struggle. This is the phrase used. What is that about? You know, that's about, I think, the path that will ultimately bring us what we can term victory. It's not going to be anything nice and neat. There's not going to be anyone on a ship signing a document or anything like that. But, you know, it'll be a kind of thing we can measure and feel in our own lives. And it will come from winning a hearts and minds struggle. Because, you know, the fact is that our enemy, specifically, I would say, are those who are at the front of the counterpoint, the counter-initiative, Islamic radicals who have taken the step from anger to violence. Why they make that step, a lot of people are angry, they've been angry for a long time. Up to now, they tended to have not blown themselves to smithereens. Why do people make that jump? There's a lot of debate about that. I don't think we understand it as clearly as we need to. Because the fact is, if it's 1 out of 1,000 who crosses that line versus 1 out of 100 versus 1 out of 10, well, the numbers are dizzying. We need to figure that out. Those who've made the jump specifically are our enemy. That's who we're fighting. But they are supported by many people who are simply angry, simply displeased, rooting for them. They don't like us for specific reasons. Our response is, yeah, you don't like us? What does that have to do with me? That's not a good response. Tough luck. That doesn't work. We need to figure out a way to win this hearts and minds battle. How do you do that? Up to now, I think we have fallen woefully short on that score. I don't think anyone disagrees about that. Many of the things we have done on a tactical footing has created essentially backlash on the broader hearts and minds terrain. The whole idea here, and Iraq fits into this as well, why are we in Iraq? People ask over and over. Well, I have an answer here. All right, there are many answers, but I think the best one is that we looked at this landscape and said, you know, weapons of mass destruction, there's no way to stop them. They're carried on civil technology. It's a spore. And what does that mean? So-called asymmetric competitors, meaning countries of all shapes and sizes, are going to have their hands on this stuff. And they'll deny us our primacy in all different parts of the world. We don't want that. And transnational actors will get it too. What do you do? Well, you can't stop them all. You need to change behavior. We're engaged in a global experiment in behavior modification. Okay? We'll make an example of Saddam Hussein. He was viewed as an easy mark. Make an example of him to display how treacherous it is to express his temerity in challenging us. That will guide the behavior of others. Of course, there's nothing patentable about demonstration models, which CEOs love. Anyone can jump in on one of those. And the Arab world said, okay, well, many jihadists will make it a demonstration model for the limits of US power. Let's see who wins. They're doing a pretty darn good job at seizing this DM. We need to win the hearts and minds battle. We have made virtually no progress. In fact, I think we've stepped back. Countries all over the world, whether they're old friends or reluctant new ones, are now backing away from us. They can't be seen anytime during daylight inclining in any way toward the US at this point. Poll in the Arab world that they fear the United States more than Iran. What is that about? We need to deal with that. We need to deal with it now. That will make clear to everybody, once we move down that course, who the enemy is, who supports the enemy, and how you drain the swamp of the force, not just a person with a bomb, but the force that underlies them. You know, Brent Scowcroft said a fascinating thing to me at one point. He said, you know, it's like a bush. The more you cut it back, the more lushly it grows. That indicates there isn't a strategy. Question. Yep.
I think you have given us a remarkable display of outrage, Mr. Susskind, here today, and I'm delighted to hear it, especially on this subject. But looking to the organs in Washington and elsewhere that ought properly to be concerned about this question, and especially from the standpoint of asking hard questions and offering some opposition, I mean the Congress and perhaps the judiciary. Is there any way to explain why They clearly have got to be getting some of these stories that you speak about in your book. Why isn't there more of an indication of opposition from relevant quarters there?
Well, you know, I think that we're wrestling with a political system, political terrain that has some profound dysfunctions at this point. You know, the partisan struggles that we've seen going on for the last decade or so, you know, are quite corrosive. You know, different eras in American life are characterized in different ways. You know, and one of the things about the power of these competing ideologies in this era and how the middle has been diminished, let's just say. I mean, it used to be the president governed from the middle. The middle's where you want it to be. That's the collecting point. You know, the notion that the founders certainly talked about of interest counteracting interest. You know, you get in the tent, you break bread. You're only going to get half a loaf if you're lucky, and the other guy too, but you'll be back to eat tomorrow morning. Those days are kind of not these days. And the thing about ideology is that it's about a kind of absolutism. You know, the questions have stopped at this point. We don't need any more. We've decided. And it also inclines someone, anyone who embraces ideology, and they're both on the left and the right, frankly, to a kind of writ of infallibility, that if we are to fail, all will be lost. Because our opponents, well, they're not even human beings, frankly. That's a trap. And that's one of the problems we're facing right now. It's very, very hard to build consensus. And it's very, very hard to get out of a tactical model of political expediency enough to embrace maybe a good idea across the aisle. And both sides are dug in on that score. You know, the fact is that sometimes the adversarial process throws salt in the eyes of justice and also the eyes of good sense. I don't have any remedies on that score. You know, the political system is often a place in which surprises occur, and maybe there will be some this year and in 2008, but, you know, I'm not optimistic.
One more. Right in front.
I want to cite Wittgenstein before I ask my question. Wittgenstein says in a different context, you don't get checkmated if you don't sit down at the chess table. Mm. Now, my question has to do with worst-case thinking, which I think you're charging the Cheney-Bush administration with doing. My experience, and I've seen it a lot in my life, worst-case thinking, my experience is that these people simply cannot change their mentality. And the question is, do you think that this crowd can change on their 1% approach to problems?
Hmm. That's a good question. You know, in a story that I wrote in the Times Magazine right before the election, a phrase emerged, which is now on Wikipedia, I guess, the reality-based community. I was charged as being a member of that. and that is the person. The White House person said, you know, you believe that solutions emerge from your judicious study of discernible reality. And I said, yeah. There's a long history behind me, I think. You know, Enlightenment principles, age of reason. Yeah. You know, we know, but we're kind of an empire now is the response. And when we act in these 32nd global news cycles, born of claim more than fact, assertion rather than authentication, you know, we create a kind of reality, a new reality. And then you can study that judiciously as you will, you RBC-er. And then we'll act again. You can study that one too, and then we'll act the third time. You can study that as well. And that's the way it all sort out. We're history's actors, and you'll study what we do. Right? Well, you know, that tends to, over time, face profound challenges, that idea. History shows again and again. I think they're facing some now. You know, reality has a way of rising up and making you listen whether you like it or not. I think now my gut tells me that they're thinking about a little more about legacy issues, and they're saying, okay, let's maybe be honest and candid. Some things haven't worked out, and then we can be candid with ourselves. Because the political mandate is so strong in this era, and the dictates of message that if the message is X, it's hard to do anything otherwise in the building in many cases, in the white building. And I think that, you know, maybe now they're thinking we need to rethink. I know that there are groups within the government at the very top that are trying to come up with a new WMD doctrine, they call it, which is a kind of replacement, I think, of some of the features of the 1% doctrine. You know, to try to, you know, let's think as clearly as we can about what the threshold should be. You know, WMDs have been out there for a long time. It's a very, very old debate. Who has them? Who should? Who shouldn't? How do we control them? How do we get unanimity of purpose with sovereign nations around the globe? I think they're scratching their heads a bit now. Will it provide outcomes? Hard to say, because the fact is that the counterpoint is that the dictate to action, that action itself is an inherent good, is one that is also very strong within our councils of state. The 1% doctrine is an action-oriented ideal. Act. You act, you create your own status quo. It's a game changer, as the president likes to say. People then need to react, and you're setting the debate. Right now with Iran, right now with some of the threats that might be emerging around the world, North Korea, there will be people in the big white building who say, let's just act. Whatever the evidence bears. Evidence with a big E is much too high a standard to have to rely upon in this era. Do we have reasonable suspicion? Will an action create a bending of behavior? How will the perceptions of what we do be received? The perceptions are almost as important as the act itself, as the thing done.
Let me ask Governor Beliles, our director, and Lee Middleditch, the chairman of the Miller Center Foundation, to escort Ron Suskind back to the Scripps Library, where he will be signing copies of the 1% Doctrine. Thank you very much, Ron Suskind. Let them take you back.